analyzer, you know, improve the number of adds the number, refine your annotation guideline to improve precision or improve, make sure that you correctly detect the mentions that have not been detected and that leads to poor recall. Yeah, and then they have, for the inactivity observation, they actually do it manually. And they have a predefined list of characters that they are interested in. So, I guess in your case, you might want to decide that there are a certain list of entities or so. I mean, whether you predefine the list of the set of entities you are interested in, or whether you discover them from the data, is, or whether you do this interactively, is also an important question. So the automatic segmentation, the segmentation is done automatically. And then they can do a web-based, this is a comment that I didn't take out. Okay, so they have this web-based tool that allows for close and distance reading, so user can view the text passages of the selected entities by clicking on the nodes. It's just a technical thing that the network graphs are created with Jeffy. That's what I wanted to mention. So just to recap, we saw, you know, three different ways of creating a visualization from the text, and some of them are more for final display, and some are more for interactive exploration of the data and refining of the hypothesis you might have about it. You might want to combine them, or to use one or the other. As I say, name entities, there is a big difference between recognition and disambiguation or resolution. And it's also important to decide on what are the different types of mentions you want to handle, the different types of entities you think are important for your analysis. And then there's this big issue of domain adaptation. So in natural language processing, there's been two main ways of doing, of adapting the tools that we have. There have been two main ways of handling texts that are in a language from an earlier period, which is either by normalizing the text. So you take your text from the 18th century and you apply a model to translate it to contemporary language. Or you do the opposite, you take the tools that have been developed on the contemporary language and you adapt them to your new language, to your earlier language. And there is also the issue that often these tools have been developed on specific corpora genre, and also you might want to have to adapt them. So if, for example, they have been trained on blogs or tweets or something, it's not so appropriate for the journal of voyage. And that's it. Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Oh. Interesting, because a few days ago I was completing an application online, and in the system they put the names of some of the institutions where I went to school in France, and over the course of the last 10 years, many French universities changed their names. So I was struggling while completing the application. Where I went to school in Paris, the name has changed. The location also has changed. And I was wondering, okay, which one should I put? Same thing with all of the degrees. Now they use almost the American system of BA, masters, and so on, which was not there when I went to school. So I'm wrestling with all of this, about which one should I use. So Any help?
So you basically got no degree from an institute that doesn't exist.
Please.
You got a no degree from an institute that does not exist.
Yeah.
But this is really the problem of name entity linking, right? So you have to have one entity that represents your university.
Yeah.
And then all the names that have been or are now referring to this entity.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think in the historical text it's even worse because some entities might be some entities don't really exist. I mean, you have to decide what.
And sometimes, you know, the historical text is referring to the group of people by the wrong name, and so you would paint it, you know, in the wrong place.
Yeah.
So listening to you present, it seems to me like no matter what way we do it, it's going to be lossy in some format. Like there's going to be something that gets left out or missed. So I guess one of the questions that I'd like to discuss is kind of what's tackleable? Like, right? Because some of these things are, my impression as an outsider who's reading the field, it seems like some of these things aren't resolved.
It's never 100%.
In the field of name, you know, NLP, and I don't know, I'd like to apply in our project, Natural Language Processing, to the historical text, but I also am not in a position to solve cutting-edge problems in computer science that haven't been resolved yet. And I don't know enough as an outsider to really know what lies within an achievable, where you can train the model and accomplish it domain, and what are the sorts of things like that are on the fringes of that I'm wrestling with, and maybe you should just close off the research question around and leave those outside.
Yeah, I think what's really important is to have evaluations. So we also, I mean, in NLP we do this a lot, but it's so in this last paper, where they do this interactive, you know, they really do, they have, okay, so what, I think, I mean, you will never have, you know, 100% reliable name entity recognition, right? But you have to have an idea of precisely what is the recall and the precision of your name entity recognition, for example. So in that sense, integrating the evaluation is really important. That's one thing, because you can say, okay, I know it's not 100%, but you can say, you know, vaguely, approximately how accurate it is. And that's really important.
Can I add one thing too? So I think, I mean, having an intrinsic, you can also make this distinction between intrinsic evaluations and extrinsic ones, right? So in this case here, you could evaluate the quality of the NER as an intrinsic, right? So how well does NER perform on these historical texts for French? But you may not care about that performance on its own, because what you're doing is you're not trying to optimize, you're not writing a paper about an NER system that you built. Right, you're writing a paper or carrying out research about what you can do with that NER. So if there's a way that you can evaluate that thing downstream too, and maybe that is, you know, just to take one example, if you want to have some measure of how much attention different cities are getting in these books, if that's something that you can measure and see how accurate it is, if that's the thing you care about, then that could be the thing that you really
optimize for,
and it provides some sort of validation for the entire process, even though it's lossy, still being okay to get to that point.
That's what I was trying to do in the alpha prototype I showed at the beginning. Was I was figuring if people are referring to one group of people from one region multiple ways, they may be 150 kilometers off from where something actually is, but if there's some way of kind of grouping it and at least using the tool to recognize where hotspots of discussion are, and then drill into. So I guess, too, we have to distinguish between what we're going to make public-facing and what's going to be just kind of an exploratory research tool. Mm-hmm. But using the entity recognition to say, hey, that's odd, let me see what this signal is, or if it's just picking up noise.
But also, you know, making it clear where the information comes from is important, right? So, I mean, the link between the nodes and the text is really important, right? Because if you show the text, then people can go and check, you know, does this make sense?
Absolutely.
Did the name entity recognition miss out on some mentions here?
Yeah.
Or, you know, so in fact, the screenshots were really bad, but in the last paper, if you click on the nodes, you see all the texts that refer to that entity. You
mm-hmm.
see the text spans, right? And you can also, I think it also displays actually in colors, you know, which name entities have been recognized, and you can see the text. So you know, just giving, you know, showing where the information comes from, that allows you to make an inference of that too, in the sense that allows you to put a dot on your graph or whatever, is also allows the user to take into account what the context was.
Is there, are there tools that exist? Because when I was doing it, I had it where I just pulled out the named entity and then ran a keyword in context for them and just was going through them and seeing, you know, long lists of the entity and what words were around it to
yeah.
see if it picked it up. But I had just kind of written something back of the napkin in Python to do it. Are there actual, like, more formal ways to work on that? I mean, I'm kind of showing my ignorance here.
Yeah, as I said, I work on generation, not on name entity recognition.
I don't know of any. Okay. No, I think
but maybe you can look into that paper, because usually people put their codes online. So
and there's a lot of kind of one-off code, but I'm wondering if there's something in the conversation that I've entirely missed, like, oh, no, this is the tool you should be using, someone made this already. So, no.
So there are a couple of GUIs out there that exist that will show you all of this at one time. The Edinburgh GeoParser is one of those. It's not going to give you any worse results than what you've gotten with what you've done so far, and they customized a version of it for me that added a French NER, and we've been talking with them about customizing it a little bit more so that it could be a little bit better for French, and that's a really nice system that shows you the geographic location, the top 10 resolution possibilities, and the full text with the entities
great.
Highlighted. So that's it's a really nice system. It's not perfect. Uses Stanford NER too for English, and. You know, so there are things out there. There's other stuff, like we invented our own system because we didn't want, because we were getting bad results. And so the GeoViz thing, I'll add something about that tomorrow to talk about that. But
because it's kind of what I did in the prototype was I clustered, and then all the
mm-hmm.
ones, the hits that it said were going to be clustered,
yeah.
I did a keywick. And I was going through the keywick and like, okay, these are all basically, that's how I discovered the problem with boats.
Right.
Because Washington kept
yeah.
showing up, but it was a ship, and
yeah.
so half the results would be referring
yeah.
to a boat, half the results were referring to a city.
It's really important to just be able to see the text right away, because then you get a sense of where the errors are, or to be able to print reports that out automatically, just like what we can do with Ludo's stuff. I can just
yeah.
see all the results as keywords and context, essentially, in a spreadsheet. And then we can correct for or validate. I think the another point to make is just how important having an annotated gold standard or like ground truth will
yeah.
be. And that's where you have to think about what the shape of and type of your entities are, because that is the backbone for any evaluation you do later.
That's the workflow we had. I mean, I used Opener, which was designed for, I think it was reviews, online product reviews in French.
Mm-hmm. Well, this isn't about like training from that, just
okay.
as to test the results that you get from any system against what you as an expert
I see.
Have said are actually the entities in the text.
So a benchmark, say, okay, here's my benchmark,
right.
run it over that limited human annotated,
right.
annotatable amount,
right.
and say, what'd you come up with, and then cross-check it.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And it's important to do that before you run the system you're evaluating. So to have data that you annotate beforehand and then run the system to see how well it recognizes entities. Because the other thing that people do occasionally is to run a system and then afterward check to see if it got each of those things right.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to introduce a lot of bias by saying that, yes, this is mostly okay. So the numbers you get end up being inflated.
So annotate it yourself beforehand.
Yeah.
And then also it has to be a completely different text, but from the same series as what you used to train it.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you just feed it the training data, then you're going to have to falsely inflate it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And ideally you would have multiple annotators annotating the same gold standard set, and then you would do an inter-annotator evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's not just one person's idea, so you would want to have like three experts annotate the same set of texts. You might have like a basic set of rules and guidelines that you decide to follow, but then you go off and you don't talk to each other and you do your annotations, and then you can evaluate all of that after the fact. And there's software that allows you to do that automatically, which is really nice.
Integrate the inter-annotator
agreement.
So on Charles's point here about the multiplicity of names that any single place can be used to refer to, this of course is a huge problem for historical texts that can change their names over the course of 500 years, right? So Constantinople is Istanbul, and every place has a bunch of names. The Getty Thesaurus of Geographic Names is a great resource for this, right? Because it gives a lot of different aliases for the same place, right? So I would encourage you to use that here too. But that really gets to like one of the important points that Claire raises here in this whole presentation, how important disambiguation is to what you're doing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think you just care about finding the specific mentions of names, for example. I mean, if you want to do anything like we were talking about this morning, like characterizing how people talk about places, knowing all the different mentions that are referring to the same place is going to be important for doing that kind of characterization. And the task of toponym resolution is inherently doing this, right? It's saying that every place can be grounded to a specific point, and that point is a unique entity. But there also might be different kinds of entities in your data that aren't groundable in that same way. And groundable in terms of a latitude and a longitude, right? So, I mean, it may be that street names or squares may be interesting, but can't be grounded to a latitude and longitude, because whatever toponym resolution system you're using doesn't have information about Lafayette Square being at a specific point on the earth. Or there may be landmarks, right? Like Giza Pyramid, that could be interesting to characterize, but doesn't, again, it would be hard to ground to a specific location.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, because one of the worries I had was if you're just doing straight frequency, you would run into not only issues with normalization, but if, say, they always refer to America as Americans, but then they also talk about Germany, but they speak about German cities specifically by name, regions by name, there may be more mentions about Germany than there are about America, but because America is consistent, if you're just looking at frequencies, America is going to float way to the top, and respectively, Germany is going to seem very unimportant. And so I figured if we grounded them in Latlons and put them in a bin, then at least you'd say, okay, those would still float back up. But then there's all kinds of issues when we get into the mapping part of now the bin has these artificial boundaries and things falling outside of it. And then, like you're saying, the things that aren't, you can't put a pushpin on a map for.
Mm. Or maybe you could, but you just need to know ahead of time to ground them on the map. Right. You could find the latitude longitude for the Pyramid of Giza and put it in your system, but you just need to know to do that, or decide to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a lot about like what you define as a place.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of the history of doing toponym resolution, that has been populated places, cities.
Right.
But for humanities research, we often kind of come up precisely against this problem of there are other kinds of place things that people talk about that can be located, that aren't as complicated as the water bottle problem, but that are like relevant to something you might want to talk about.
or even the difference between like point polygon. I mean, if somebody's saying the West versus Reno,
yeah,
and both of those, where would you locate the West?
Yeah.
Elijah was working on this when he was at Stanford a bit with time. You know, things were 10 years ago as opposed to 2010. I mean, those are not the same thing. One has a vagueness
yeah.
in its boundaries, and one is very specific.
Yeah. You can think about hierarchies, and you know, if that was important to you, you could say all these German cities are in Germany, and therefore, if there are questions that I want to think about on a nation level, then I
yeah.
can query for things that fit into certain hierarchies because I have a gazetteer that includes that relational information.
That gets very strongly at the relationship between the tool available and the research question that you're asking, right? Because it takes a lot of work to build that hierarchy, and the path of least resistance might be because the gazetteer is already well suited for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think because there is no gazetteer that's going to really do very well for French language place names for the entire world.
You say it like that, it seems like a tall order.
Not at all. It is a very interesting idea to think about sets of places that you know about for which you can have a curated list,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to just like seeing what you get. It's really hard to work at the world scale because a lot of the methods for disambiguation are about, you know, oh, well, we can limit the geographical area of interest to this, or we can do this. And like, this is something that we struggle with a lot too because we're working at a world scale.
Yeah.
So it's hard. And so it can be good to have more focused areas where you can work with a set of places that you know about, or you can restrict your location, and just like by continent can be really helpful. And a lot of French place names will be Saint this or Saint that, and you need to be able to know how to disambiguate that. And the Getty Thesaurus is great for like places where art things happen, but not necessarily small towns in New Caledonia, right? Like that's the problem. The Getty is really good for some kinds of places and not for others. So actually, on Living with Machines, we're using Wikipedia now as the spine for our gazetteer. And so you can change the language, you know, input there, and just what our gazetteer does is it grabs any article in Wikipedia that has a location
mm-hmm.
associated with it. So it's not just like articles that have a type of populated place or something like that.
Is there, I mean, going off of what Claire is presenting on, was if we segment the text and build some sort of topic, wouldn't that be a way around, like if they're saying Saint-Pierre and it's in a particular network of tokens, then we know it's this, you know, is there some way to do that programmatically to disambiguate based off of, like you were saying, with the John Smiths?
Mm.
Or is that a purely human coming in and saying, no, these John Smiths belong over here, and then retraining the model and rerunning it?
I think you can do this automatically.
Yes.
Based on the context. I mean, so basically it's basically a clustering algorithm, right? So
mm-hmm.
you're mapping. Okay.
Yeah, there are several solutions. Some are based on map-based disambiguations, and they try to build clusters of location of the different place names that occur in the texts. So for instance, here in one article, we can have several places. And so if you have one that is ambiguous, you can use the other one to to disambiguate this one. So for instance, the typical case is Paris. You have Paris in Texas and Paris in France. So within the text, you have other cities that are in France. You can understand that it's Paris in France and not Paris in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be automatically done. And there are also some other solutions also working on the context and all on the other entities that you have in the text, working on hierarchy, for instance, or semantic links that you can find on the linking ontology or things like this.
But that speaks to the importance of the last talk of having the proper metadata around articles, right? You need to have the beginning and end point to know this article is talking about. There's some sort of inherent structure to, we understand that this person was talking about one topic, and we can identify that through the tokens. Otherwise, if it's boundless, then where does that window start and end?
And that's why having titles marked up can be really helpful. Because, for example, we know in the encyclopedia for articles that are classified as geography articles, 99% of the time, that's a place, and that the rest of the article is a description of that place. And so if a place name occurs in a title, then that's also, you know, that's a piece of information you can use. As opposed to it just being another word in an article, right? It's weighted differently. It has a different meaning.
And then what does everyone think about what degree of lossiness is acceptable in accuracy? I mean, I think 10 years ago there was a great tolerance for fuzziness. I don't know if that's still there, but it can still be useful to share, like maybe something at the global scale, this is what we say, this is what we see, but then drill down and this is what we're confident in. I don't know if kind of we're scale, if we have those scales of confidence level, is that, or should we just throw that out and say that's, you know,
I have nightmares about this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you like to share your nightmares with us, Katie?
More of them? Because I think that historians especially have this kind of idea that, if you're using digital technologies, the computer is going to give you this really exact answer about all of this information, and it's going to plot all the points, and it's going to be right, and it's not, right? And we haven't found all the place names in the text. And so I think that what you have to adjust is not, what you have to adjust is the question. I think, like, you know, David mentioned this, that it's about thinking about what NLP can give you, what does it do well, instead of trying to make it do something that it's not going to do well. It's not going to give you 100% recall or precision. So given that, what sub sort of task does it actually, maybe unexpectedly, give you really useful data on? Like maybe if you limit your inquiry to cities with people more than 50,000, then you're probably going to get much better results than if you try and capture all places. Or, you know, if you think about certain types of places, or if you, again, like, restrict geographic location. It just determines the kind of questions that you ask, and it's really important to think about that and how you can make a convincing argument about something that has a spatial element when you're not pretending like you have all of the information.
Right.
And historians are used to thinking that way when we go to the archives, because we know that the archive is not complete, and we know that all of our examples are not all the examples that there could be. And so you think if we can tap into that level of acknowledgement with this kind of, you know, confidence,
yeah,
then that is what we have to figure out how to do. Now, doing that is what we're only just starting to do, but it's changing the questions and remembering that we never have all the information.
And the problem with NLP here is that you will have several stages of evaluation, because there are several tasks. You have the pre-processing with all the tokenization, with the part of speech, and you can have error here. And if you have error in the part of speech, then you will have error.